Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, June 1st. It being June 1st, it's the first day of Pride Month. On this show, we'll be doing Pride-related segments every Thursday in June that we hope will be fresh and illuminating, and both for LGBTQ plus listeners and straight cisgender listeners as well. And we'll start by turning to a term that many of you have heard by now and turning it on its head. Even if you don't know any trans people, you've probably heard the term gender dysphoria, right? The National Institutes of Health defines gender dysphoria as a marked incongruence between a person's experienced or expressed gender and the one they were assigned at birth. Wikipedia defines gender dysphoria as the distress a person experiences due to that mismatch. The Cleveland Clinic website notes that many insurance companies require you to submit specific documentation of consistent gender dysphoria before they will cover a gender-affirming surgery. So, in an oversimplified nutshell, that's gender dysphoria. And many of you, even with no trans folks in your life, probably had at least heard that term and had a vague sense of what that is. But let's turn that term and the distress that comes with it on its head, because there is also such a thing as gender euphoria. You all know what euphoria is, that feeling of extreme happiness and elation and joy that I hope everyone listening right now has experienced at least sometimes in your life. And if you do a Google search for gender euphoria, you'll find millions of hits. One of the first to come up, the website Healthline, which defines gender euphoria as feeling right in your gender, when you can look at the way your gender is presented and received and feel happiness or joy. So as we begin our Thursday Pride Month series here on the show, amid all these laws and policies being passed in all these states trying to erase non-binary and trans people in one way or another, we will talk about those hate laws some of the time and gender dysphoria some of the time. But let's start on the idea of gender euphoria, feeling right in the way your gender is at least presented and sometimes, hopefully, perceived. We'll invite your gender euphoria calls in a minute, and we're very happy to have two guests for this. Imara Jones is back with us, a former journalist in residence at WNYC's The Green Space, a Peabody and Emmy Award winner. She is the creator of Translash Media, which includes the Translash podcast with Imara Jones and much more. She was also on Mayor Bill de Blasio's New York City Commission on Gender Equity. Also with us, Tuck Woodstock, whose bio page starts with journalist, educator, audio producer, and alleged former mayor of Portland. What? Maybe we'll find out about that alleged former mayor status. But actually, he's based in Queens and is probably best known as host of the award-winning podcast Gender Reveal. He has also consulted for This American Life and many other productions. So, Imara, welcome back to the show. Tuck, welcome, and welcome both of you back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for having me.
It's an honor.
Tuck, would you be okay starting us off by describing gender euphoria, either as a journalist, an educator, or in personal terms about yourself?
Sure. I mean, honestly, I think you did a great job explaining it, Brian. But as you said, we hear so much about gender dysphoria, this dissonance between how we're feeling or maybe how other people are treating us and the gender we know ourselves to be. And gender euphoria is simply the feeling of all of these things going right for us. And I think that people who aren't trans, because they might not experience the same levels of gender dysphoria, don't feel these same levels of gender euphoria. But when you're used to having a hard time being seen as your gender, either by yourself or others, these moments where everything finally aligns and feels right can be really, really powerful. So something you may have seen if you're on TikTok or other social media will be, for example, photos of someone who has just had a gender-affirming surgery, revealing the results of those surgeries for the first time. That can be a huge moment of elation, but it can be little things too. So, for example, yesterday I had to go get passport photos taken at the place on my block who, you know, takes the photos, and the guy was kind of insinuating to me that I might want to fix some stuff about my appearance. He kept kind of being like, do you want to fix your hair? Do you use your face okay? And I got my photo. I'm like, no, I look great. And I was comparing that photo to the photo I took 10 years ago for my passport. And it really did bring me a lot of joy to see those photos in comparison. And I just thought the photo that was taken for my passport, which is so silly, really made me feel exactly like who I am. So that could be just a small moment of gender euphoria.
Yeah, nice description. Mara, same question. Gender euphoria, is it more than just the absence of dysphoria?
I think for me, and of course, you know, my experience is individual and unique, because one of the amazing things about trans people in our community is how broad and diverse it is. But for me personally, what I can say is, I think it was the day that I didn't wake up having to think about my gender. And for me, it wasn't necessarily a balloon drop, but it's to say this feeling of, you know, crossing a threshold in that way, marked by some celebratory moment. It was really when I began to notice that I wasn't thinking about my gender anymore, and I wasn't second guessing myself, and other people were starting to interact with me in a way that was consistent with the way I've always been inside of myself. And so I think for me, it was much more of a quiet revolution. You know, it's kind of like that Jill Scott Heron quote where the revolution isn't seen, right? It's because it starts in the mind. And for me, that was much more the place that I remember being. That's how I experienced gender euphoria, is the ability to live and to be as myself in the way that I've always been.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me that you put it in that way, that includes sort of not having to think about your gender. Because I was thinking about this and the word pride as well, as in Pride Month, in relation to myself. And I identify as a straight cisgender male. Cisgender, for people who don't know, just means I identify and feel myself to be the gender I was identified as at birth. And I was realizing that I think I don't experience gender euphoria or dysphoria in the sense of distress or elation about my gender. It's just who I am. And same with the idea of pride. I feel like I'm neither proud nor ashamed of being straight and cis. It's just the way I came out. I'm proud or ashamed of things I choose to do, not of something that I didn't control. But my next thought is that I have the privilege of not feeling pride or shame about my gender or sexual orientation, because nobody is hating on me or thinking I'm weird or of questionable morality or trying to fix my appearance for my passport photo or questioning my mental health just for being those things that I had no control over, right? If people are marginalized in those ways, of course they're going to experience pride in their identity, because their identity is embattled. And others sometimes think you should be ashamed of who you are. But all of that is just my musings. So, Imara, you want to follow up on what you said a minute ago and maybe talk about the meaning of pride, as in Pride Month to you, living in your skin and doing the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things. I think that that's right. I think that, you know, what's fascinating, I think a part of the freak out in many ways that's being stoked about trans people is based in the fact of what you just said, which is that, you know, most people don't wake up thinking about gender, and then suddenly you have to think about something that you've never thought about before. Can be shocking, right? It can be unsettling. But for trans people, that's all we've ever done our entire lives. And so what alignment can mean for some people, this is not true for everyone, but for me, what alignment has meant for me is the ability to be able to, again, live as myself without the same you know, questions that I often had before transition or even earlier stages in my transition. So I think that that's exactly right. And I think that, you know, what gender euphoria for me is that it means a certain level of peace that I never had before. I think that with regards to pride, I think pride is so many things. But I tell people every year that I think that pride is a recommitment of the vows that are committed to the equality and human rights of our community. You know, it's grounded in the commemoration of the Stonewall Uprising and what that meant in terms of galvanizing our community as a whole, of course, led by trans women and in many respects trans people of color, to that larger project. And so I think that it is a time for us to reflect and to feel good about ourselves and to support each other in really important ways. And a part of that is expressing joy and celebration, but it's also, you know, a commitment to the unfinished business that still remains.
So listeners, first trans or non-binary listeners, we invite your calls describing your experiences of gender euphoria to 12-433-WNYC. You can also describe your experience of pride, 212-433-9692, first priority for trans or non-binary identifying folks. And in addition to that, our guests, the journalists and creators, Imara Jones and Tuck Woodstock, have also been generous enough to volunteer for this segment to answer some trans 101 questions, if you will, from you and from me, for people not in the community trying to understand trans and non-binary identity better these days because it's so in the news, because it's under attack, or maybe because you're realizing for the first time that there are actually trans or non-binary people who you know. So trans and non-binary listeners, you're invited to call with your experiences of gender euphoria. Anyone else with kind of a trans 101 question, also 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or you can text us at that same number. Tuck, do you think it's important to acknowledge and publicly discuss gender euphoria as a thing because it's real and there's so much discussion of gender dysphoria in the media, some of which is supportive, but which still makes it sound like being trans comes mostly with distress, not also with a lot of joy?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, you said it so perfectly already, but I think that folks who maybe don't know a lot of trans people and are just hearing about us in the news are hearing so much about us suffering and being persecuted and generally having a bad time. And it's true that trans people are generally having a bad time right now because of laws that are being passed attacking us across the country. But being trans includes so many moments of joy, both personally and by building community. And as Imara said, also just the joy of realizing that you don't have to wake up and think about your gender anymore because you've gotten to a place where that's not the biggest problem in your life. You actually feel good and you can move on to having hobbies. And so I think it's really important to talk about the fact that trans kids and trans adults can be not just surviving, but absolutely thriving, especially when we are allowed to live as the genders that we are without fear of persecution, because it's this reminder that if we're seeing all these depictions of sad or struggling trans folks, it's not because being trans is inherently negative or sad or hard. It's really just because of the way that society is treating us. And when left to our own devices, we're having a great time. And, you know, not to plug my own work, but I host this podcast, Gender Reveal, in which trans people talk to each other. And we very rarely talk about the type of laws that are being passed. And we really try to focus on other parts of our lives. And it's such a treat to just get to talk to each other about the things that we're passionate about or that make us happy without having to focus on all of the struggles and the dysphoria of it all. So I really appreciate you centering that as well to a larger audience.
And here's Rachel in Philadelphia with a gender euphoria call, I think. Rachel, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hello, Brian. Thank you very much for doing the segment. I'm going to make this really brief because this is one of those things I've been dying to say every time you've done a segment, and unfortunately I haven't been able to ring through. The moment of my euphoria after decades of dysphoria was the night before my surgery, 35 years ago, when I said Kaddish for my old self.
You said Kaddish for your old self. And for people who don't know, Kaddish is the Jewish prayer for the dead.
Exactly. I felt for 30-some-odd years, every time I heard the name that I was given at birth, that they were talking to somebody else. It's as if I kept calling you Fred all day long, Brian, and you kept saying, no, my name is Brian, not Fred. And right. I kept saying, oh, that's nice, Fred.
I hear you.
That's the way I felt for 35.
Isn't there an expression in the trans world also, a term, dead name? People say my dead name. Meaning the name that you left behind?
I have worked hard. I was a fairly well-known actor and voice actor and producer in Los Angeles and broadcaster for many, many, many years. I started my career at WNEW AM and as an engineer. As a matter of fact, I even interviewed at WNYC once. Anywho, long story short, I had to work hard to get rid of that dead name. And I have been so lucky that I have not been called that in years.
Well, I'm going to call you Rachel, and thank you very much for your call. That was wonderful. I hope you get through again.
Yeah.
Please call us again. Thank you very, very much. And we're going to go right to, I think, another gender euphoria story from Meg in Bordentown in New Jersey, south of Trenton there. Hi, Meg. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me. Long-time listener, first-time caller. For me, gender euphoria is, for me, the first moment I felt it was, I'm a trans woman, and the first time someone looked at me, it was in a store, and I was presenting, and someone looked at me and said, "Can I help you, ma'am?" And I know that sounds unbelievably trivial, but the fact that someone saw me for who I am, and I didn't have to invite it, that was so, so powerful. You know, there's a place and an importance in making these sorts of things and pronouns explicit, but sometimes it's really just nice to be seen for who you are. And it's something I wanted to sort of add is for, you know, cisgender listeners who maybe aren't familiar with this concept, you've experienced gender euphoria. When you lean into something that's associated with, or you associate, I should say, with mm-hmm. the gender you were assigned at birth, like, you know, you a guy with sports or a woman with sports for that matter, or, you know, someone who, you know, you were a great girl boss at work today. You like, you did a great thing as a woman. That's gender euphoria too. We just don't necessarily always name it that because it just seems so obvious that you should feel good about it.
Yeah, so it doesn't come to your awareness like being a majority of many kinds in your society that just feels like normal. It doesn't even feel like a thing. It's the people who are in the minority in one way or another who realize because they walk around being othered in so many ways that there are even those differences. So thank you very much for that, Meg. Amara, what are you thinking as you listen to either of those calls?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, for me, it's the quiet moment, right? And that's what we just heard. And I think that, you know, one of the things that gets lost in the, again, the manufactured debate about who we are and then the strong feelings that are unleashed as a result is the fact that we are human beings, right? And that for most human beings, no matter, you know, who you are, a lot of your life is about the quiet, boring moments that no one ever sees. And for me, I know that a lot of those quiet, boring moments were always tormented. And the ability to be able to live without that torment is something that I can't put a price on. And it's hard to describe it unless you've ever experienced it. And it left you. And I just wanted to also say, excuse me, to Rachel experienced that entire thing of like, you know, the more that the more that my, the older that I got and the more that my body changed, the more that the world began to interact with me, with the gender that I was assigned at birth, the more and more distant I actually felt from the world. And I felt that there was like this Russian doll effect where there was a person inside of a person, and that people were seeing the exterior, but there was something that was so much profound and so much deeper began to be more and more hidden away. And that the entire process of transition is about removing those layers so that the world can actually see you for who you are. And that for me is gender euphoria, for us to be able to see the brilliance and the beauty and even the banality of every single individual human being without the layers that we heap upon them. And I think that that's what everybody wants. And for trans people, that task is just so much greater.
Yeah. And, you know, it brings me back to that definition that I read at the top about gender euphoria, or of gender euphoria, from the website Healthline, that I think the last caller brought up. It was when people were perceiving her as a woman, right? And that Healthline definition was feeling right in your gender. And when you can look at the way your gender is presented and received, and feel happiness or joy in that. And when I first read that definition, I thought, well, I'm not sure I really like it, because it still gives power to other people when it says, when you can look at the way your gender is presented and received and feel happiness or joy. I'm sure a lot of trans people have gender euphoria, even though they're being perceived hostily in one way or another. But you're laying that out too. It's the presentation, the feeling internally, and the reception can add to it.
Yeah. Can I just add one more thing, Brian, which is that, you know, I think that one of the things I that really helps me is that I think about the fact that, you know, for most of human history, our existence as trans and gender nonconforming people was a natural part of human society, and that it's really over the last 500 years with the imposition of a certain type of economic structure and ideology that developed in Western Europe and then was exported around the world, that we've become a controversy. And so even, you know, our experience of pain and anguish is manufactured. And so much about what we're doing, and this is revealed in a text conversation, is what we're doing is we are undoing that damage and being ourselves in a way that for most of our time as human beings, we've been able to be.
We're going to take a break. And we're going to continue with Amara Jones and Tuck Woodstock. By the way, I just found out, Amara, I'm not telling anything you don't know about yourself, but I'll tell everybody else, I just found out that you're on the Time 100 this year, which is that magazine's list of the 100 most influential people in the world. I think you're in the Time Magazine Time 100 icons section. So congratulations on being recognized and perceived in that way.
Thank you so much.
We're going to continue in a minute, and we're going to kind of move to the Trans 101 section of the conversation now that we've taken some trans euphoria calls and had that conversation for a while with our guests, Amara Jones and Tuck Woodstock. So, cisgender people, any questions you have about being trans? I have a few here that I will kick it off with. But if you'd like to ask something that you're curious about, because this is just in your awareness more than it was maybe a few years ago, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or text us at that same number with your question. And of course, trans and non-binary people can continue to call as well. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC on this first day of Pride Month, as we continue to talk about trans euphoria, not just trans dysphoria, and other aspects of trans life, with Amara Jones, a former journalist in residence at WNYC's The Green Space, a Peabody and Emmy Award winner, creator of Translash Media, which includes the Translash podcast with Amara Jones, and someone who's been named to the Time 100 for this year, as I said before the break. Also with us, Tuck Woodstock, whose bio page starts with journalist, educator, audio producer, and alleged former mayor of Portland, really based in Queens, and he is probably best known as host of the award-winning podcast Gender Reveal. Tuck, what is that about being the former alleged mayor of Portland?
Sure. So I lived in Portland for 10 years and I grew up in the area and I was a journalist there for a long time. And I was covering the 2020 protests in Portland that went on for more than 100 consecutive nights. And some people were having some feelings about the current mayor, Ted Wheeler, who was also mayor during that period. And somehow it just became a joke online that I was the true mayor. So then when I moved to New York last year, I abdicated my unofficial Twitter mayorship, but I kept it in my bio just as some fun flavor for interviews like these.
There you go. So former alleged mayor of Portland, among other things, Tuck Woodstock. I have a question for you. I'll call it a 101 question. I really appreciate, by the way, both of you volunteering to do a little Trans 101, because on one level, it's rude to even ask other people to explain themselves or to sort of do the work for other people to understand you. So just know I don't take your generosity on this for granted. But I think a lot of people don't yet understand the difference between being trans and being non-binary, or sometimes we hear the term gender fluid. So, Tuck, can you make that distinction or describe the spectrum a little bit as you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the word transgender just describes anyone whose gender does not neatly match the sex that they were assigned at birth. And so that is an umbrella term that can include trans men, trans women, as well as non-binary people. And non-binary is just another umbrella term under the trans umbrella that describes anyone who does not feel themselves to be neatly a man or a woman. So you might hear all sorts of different terms, non-binary, genderqueer, gender fluid, agender, various other terms that you or I may not have heard yet. These would all fall under the non-binary umbrella. But really, non-binary people are also trans, because trans simply means the gender that, you know, your gender not being what you were assigned at birth. So if you weren't assigned non-binary at birth, which almost no one is, then non-binary falls under the trans umbrella.
Another 101 question, Imara. The word transition, now that we've talked a little bit about the word non-binary, would it be accurate to say there are social, legal, and medical aspects to transitioning, and you don't always have to be engaged in all three to be a trans individual?
That's right. I mean, first of all, I would love to just take, you know, text definition and carry it around with me and wait. Anyone who had questions, it was such a brilliant, succinct overview in a way that everyone can understand. Transition is about aligning yourself with the identity, the gender identity that you have. The broad series of terms and umbrellas that I just took us through. Transition is about you aligning yourself, moving from however the world labeled you or saw you or raised you with what your actual gender identity is, whether or not it be trans, masculine, trans feminine, gender non-conforming, non-binary. And so there's so many layers and aspects of transition. And if, you know, we had it visually, you would have sort of a wheel with all of these different sections. There's medical transition, which not everyone engages in. And then under medical transition, there are, options in terms of whether or not people go on hormones or not, or whether or not you have surgeries and which type of surgeries, because there's a range of them. So that's medical. There's legal. Do you change your name? Do you change your gender marker? For some people, the source of their dysphoria may be their name, but not their gender marker. And so again, there are options there. There's dress and presentation, which is another area of transition. There's also voice. People can transition their voice as well. And so I think that we have to think about transition, again, not as a set set of things that happen where a person is moving from one thing to another, from one binary to another, but rather it is a variety of options and tools that people have in order to be able to align themselves with their gender identity. And so we have to complicate transition is the point.
Yeah. And getting back to the question of non-binary as opposed to trans talk, here's a text that came in from a listener that asks, why are non-binary persons being shoehorned into binary infrastructures? The infrastructures need to be expanded. And I'm not sure I totally understand the question or the sentiment, but maybe you do.
Sure, I can make it work. I mean, when we're talking about those different types of transition that you and Amara were both discussing, non-binary people, like anyone really, can pick and choose what elements of those transition care that they choose to receive. So for example, some non-binary people may want gender-affirming surgeries like top surgery or bottom surgery. Some may not. Some may change their name. Some may not. Some may go on hormones. Some may not legally, blah, blah, blah. I will say that this infrastructure was made for men and women. And in fact, when we're talking about transition-related care, everything that trans people are doing is stuff that cisgender people also do and also have access to. So when we're talking about particularly medical care that trans people access, including non-binary people, cisgender people also have access to all of that care. And in fact, it's much easier for them to do so. Because of that, all of the medical care, the legal systems, the bureaucratic systems, they're all built for men and women. And that's changing just a little bit. We see non-binary gender markers becoming available in certain states. And in fact, on like US passports, for example, but it's still pretty binary. So when I was signing up for surgery and was going through that process, I was actually asked on the call, is your surgery male to female or female to male? And I was like, that's not how I describe my body, actually. I would call it, you know, a gender-affirming top surgery. I could call it a double mastectomy if you want to get really technical, but I don't consider myself going female to male. That's not the language I use for myself. So no. If that's what the caller is talking about or the texter is talking about, then I certainly agree. I do think it's improving a little bit, but we still live in a very binary system.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question along those lines, because if you're, well, let me just get you straight first in the way you're describing yourself. Do you call yourself a, you use he, him pronouns. Mm-hmm. Do you call yourself a trans man?
I do at this point. Back when I was pursuing surgery, I identified more with the word non-binary, which I would still use to describe myself. Why not? But at that time, I was very much more of a like a they, them, non-binary person. And so that language really rubbed me the wrong way. And now I'm more in like a he, they space. I'll take whatever people give me, to be honest, which is, I want to also say while we're talking about this, a really common experience with trans people in that our pronouns might change multiple times and the words we use to describe ourselves might change multiple times because, you know, we're all exploring ourselves as we go along.
So as a follow-up, what does being a man feel like to you, Tuck? And Amara, I'll ask you next about feeling like a woman. But Tuck, having been identified at birth as a girl, what's masculinity, if that's even the right word, in terms of how you have experienced your gender identity in adopting he, him pronouns?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I'm not sure that I or anyone really know. When I'm teaching workshops to cisgender people, which I do often, I will ask cisgender people to tell me, without describing your body or the words that other people have assigned to you, how do you know what your gender is? So if you can't look at your genitals, you can't look at your birth certificate, how do you know that you're a man or how do you know that you're a woman? And people can almost never give a good answer because at the end of the day, gender is really something that we're feeling in ourselves. We're using context clues like, okay, people who are described as men look like this and act like this and like these things. Women look like this, like these things. Do I fit in those? Do I want to follow those rules? Is something else speaking to me? And we're using all of these different societal clues plus our own internal feelings to figure out what gender feels best for us at any given moment, any given part of our lives. And because of that, it's really hard to answer questions like that. And yet, in order for trans people to access gender-affirming care and even legal and social transition, we're often asked to answer those questions. So when I challenge cisgender people to answer them, it's sort of to prove that there aren't easy answers for any of us, including cisgender people. And at the end of the day, it's just sort of the gut feeling of what makes the most sense to us in the system that we're living in right now. And that doesn't mean that it always fits perfectly, but it's just what feels right out of the given options.
Yeah. So, Amara, same question for you. As a trans woman, what are those female gender traits or feelings you recognized in yourself once upon a time?
Yeah, really early for me. I think, well, for me, when you first asked it, I was like, oh, how does it feel to be, a woman? And I was like, oh, it feels like how I've always been. So that was also an interesting, first thing that popped into my head. You know, I think it's a variety of things, and it's really hard to talk about these things without devolving to stereotype. And that's because, you know, gender is this weird space, this weird amalgamation of, as Tuck said, biological context clues with cultural traits that we as a society have said and assigned to women, but in other societies haven't been. So again, we have to know that this is it's an amalgamation, which means that it's hard to define. So, but for me, some of the traits are people who are concerned with nurturing, but nurturing can be in a broad sense. It can be community, it can be society. People who are concerned very much with the emotional lives and emotional health of people. I think a focus on beauty and aesthetics. People who are fundamentally concerned with life, right? Life outside of construction, life outside of enforcement, life outside of imposition. And as I describe these things, people who are cisgender male may listen and say, well, I feel those things. And that's because if you are a healthy person, then you have a combination of masculine and feminine traits. People who are not healthy don't have some combination of each. So I hope that in describing these things, if you are a cis man and you identify with what I said, that you realize that that's a sign of health. Because if you didn't have that, you would most likely be a psychopath. So I think that we have to understand that as well, that we, even if you are a cis, if you're a healthy person, you contain what we call masculine and feminine traits that are balanced in a way that help you be a positive human being.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, Tuck, I'll admit my own bias here, I guess, as a straight cis man. I've been steeped in feminism enough to think that generally women are maybe a little more whole than men. And that's a generalization, so take it for what it's worth. But I came to believe long ago that it's more likely that a woman can be strong and be a provider quite easily, some of the things we identify with masculinity traditionally, but also tend to be more relational, more cooperative, less competitive, and so maybe more whole in more cases, the way that humanity has evolved, and men have a lot of work to do. So again, as a generalization and not to overstate it, but we talk about toxic masculinity for good reason. There really isn't toxic femininity in the same way, I don't think. It's not a term in the lexicon. So in the context of gender euphoria, what is it about being a man that makes you feel good and proud about that?
Totally. Oh my gosh, no, I'm so glad you asked. I mean, everything you're saying is true, and I think that's what's such a delight about being a trans guy, is getting to carry all of the lessons we learned from being, you know, socialized as women, being taught the lessons that girls are taught, experiencing what it's like to be perceived as a girl by men. And in fact, something that I've noticed now that I'm being read as a man by other people is that men are so much nicer to random men than they are to random women. And it is messed up that an experience that I can have of gender euphoria is just a guy being nice to me at the coffee shop. But it really is true. And that's not why I transitioned. That's not something that I knew would happen. But it really has been bizarre to see the way that men act and treat men compared to women and other people.
And I'll admit being a little surprised by that, because I would think, traditionally, men what's the word? I'm trying to think of a word. There's a word, but it means, you know, that men are going to treat women with a certain deference.
Chivalry
is exactly the word. And, you know, if you're talking about strangers online in a coffee shop or something like that.
Totally.
But your experience is the opposite.
I think that as women or people who are being perceived as women, we're used to being a little bit suspicious of men, and with good reason. So if a man was being chivalrous or nice to me and he was perceiving me as a woman, I might be thinking, okay, what is his motivation here? What does he want from me? And I wouldn't really be able to trust it at face value. Whereas a guy is just being nice to me as a guy, I'm like, okay, yeah. He's not right. Trying to do anything weird, you know? So I think that's the difference, is this level of sort of safety. And again, that's not the reason that I would transition, but it is a good feeling, I have to say, to get to move into the world and feel less like I'm looking over my shoulder at all times, for at least one reason. Now I just have to do it for being trans, but you know, there's always something.
Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for hosting the conversation. I'd like to bring up a bit about the pushback and what I've noticed time and time again. It's sort of the same refrain you'll get from people who are, on various parts of the not having it spectrum to, you know, just straight homophobes and transphobes. They say, well, we're fine with it. Just don't throw it in our face. You know, I don't want it to be shoved down my throat. And basically, it's an argument for going back into the closet. So I'm wondering what your guests have to say about that, how they respond. I think it has to do with something to do with a reluctance and a resistance to do work on themselves and to evolve in whatever direction they want. Mm-hmm. I see the sort of like gender evolution as something where humanity is coming into, like, you know, to touch on what you were saying, a wholeness in many, many different aspects that we need. And just one more thing about enforcement and the closet. So much of the time, even primarily, I would argue, it's not interpersonal. It's the institutions of the society, specifically policing and over-policing. So a word of support and solidarity to Queen Jean and a few other people who were arrested yesterday at Washington Square Park for the Black Trans Lives Matter march. The NYPD threw ungodly amount of, you know, hundreds of SRG protest cops, basically.
Yeah.
The arrest was over a megaphone that Queen Jean had. Not a permit for. And in a sense, you could read that as saying, you know, she was too loud. She was too loud for the gentrified area. She was too loud for the cops, and spent the night in, in the 7th Precinct for it.
Michael, I'm gonna leave it there. Thank you for all of that. Here's a Trans 101 question coming in from a listener via text. The question is, cis straight white guy here, question about refrain. Sorry, that's not the text I thought I was going to. Here it is. My Trans 101 question. My son reports most of the kids in his high school are LGBTQ, of whom many are trans or non-binary. This seems like a great increase from the past. Why are the numbers going up so much? Are people just more open about who they are? And I'll just say, he wrote it as, my son reports most of the kids in his high school are LGBTQ. I imagine it's not most, but Amara, it's still the premise of the question. The numbers seem to be going up so much. A generation ago, most people may have known gay and lesbian people, but not trans and non-binary people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just also want to echo the sentiments of concern about Queen Jean. And her arrest yesterday. I think that one of the things that we have to realize, and this is one of the things that I've spent a lot of time reporting on over the last year and a half, and this is a hard thing for people to understand, but that our very conversation, the conversation that we have about trans people, is actually heavily shaped by an intentional disinformation campaign by the Christian nationalist movement. And one of the ideas that they have deliberately released into the bloodstream of our culture and conversation is this idea of trans contagion, specifically amongst young people. The idea of rapid onset gender dysphoria, that there's kind of a popcorn effect where one person is coming out and then all these other kids are saying that they're trans as a way to be distinct, and all the rest of it. And we know that that entire concept is based on totally debunked and discredited science, and now is pseudoscience. But because it seems an easy answer for why there are more trans kids now than ever that we know about, it's really been picked up and embraced. And the problem is that it's leading to trans kids to be harmed because their parents are believing that this is a quote phase, close quote, and are denying them care. And it's increasing the harm, including the suicidality of trans kids who don't get this care. And I think it's a very easy answer, Brian. I think that, you know, over the last 10 years, and it really is over the last 10 years, people who have been born are able to see trans people in the world and in society. That's certainly not something that I saw growing up in the 80s. And you didn't even see that even if you were a kid in the early 2000s. It's really past 2014 where there's been trans people who are visible. And once you're visible, you're able to say, oh, I know who that person is. That person is like me. And that leads to your journey of self-revelation. Look, we know that trans kids are still in the very low single digits in this country, in just statistically. And so if you see it going from 0.5% to 1%, it seems like an explosion because it's doubled, but it's still, you know, extremely, extremely a small number of people in terms of being a minority. And I think that what we have to do is to understand that the world is opening, the world is changing, and what was brutally repressed and erased in even harsher terms is less so. And that small crack in our society is what is allowing more trans kids to say, this is who I am, and to be seen. And I think that it's not new. We're not new. The only thing that's happened is that trans kids now have created a space for themselves where they're able to say, this is who I am, so please accept me.
And
if
listeners,
I could just say very quickly, anecdotally.
Real quick, Duck. Real quick.
Yeah, so quick. I went to high school like 15 years ago, and no one was gay, no one was trans. That was simply not allowed socially. Now so many of my peers are also queer or trans, and we really were queer or trans the whole time, but we just did not have the space to know that about ourselves and know that about each other. And so it's not that these kids are gay or transer than us. It's just that we didn't have that space, but we grew up to be queer and trans anyway. That's all I wanted to say.
That's exactly right.
And listeners, that's our segment for the first day of Pride Month. We will be centering trans and other LGBTQIA plus identities in this weekly Thursday series as the month goes on. For now, our great thanks to Amara Jones, creator of Translash Media, including the Translash podcast with Amara Jones, and Tuck Woodstock, host of the podcast Gender Reveal, among many other things. Thank you both so much. Happy Pride.
Thank you so
Happy
much.
Pride.
Happy Pride, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. So if someone were to ask, what are you? How would you respond? Would you say you're a parent, a partner, a friend? Well, if you're in the United States, chances are you would identify yourself by your job title, rather than identifying with being a New York Liberty fan or playing guitar, maybe. You might feel that your job, as a banker, a journalist, whatever, is what defines you. This is workism, an ideology predominating over the United States that, quote, asks two distinct pursuits, money and personal fulfillment, to coalesce. That's according to our guest, journalist Simone Stolzoff, who argues for the separation of these two pursuits more in a new book called The Good Enough Job, Reclaiming Life from Work. Simone, welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is a good enough job? Why should we accept a good enough job as opposed to a dream job or something in which the work itself fulfills us?
Yeah, I mean, you hear the phrase and you might think it's like a slacker manifesto, you know, a good enough job, something that I can do just to skate by. But in my view, a good enough job is a job that allows you to be the person that you want to be. For some people, it might be a job that pays a certain wage that allows them to, say, live in New York City. For others, it might be a job that lets them get off work at a certain time so they can pick up their kids from school. But more than anything, it's a vision of a world where our lives are the predominant thing that our careers support, as opposed to the other way around.
So listeners, we can open up our phones on the question, do you have a good enough job as opposed to a dream job? I'm sure many people listening right now are looking for a job like one or the other. So tell us, what is your good enough job and how does it allow you to fill your life with other things that the job leverages rather than your life leveraging your job? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or text us at that same number, or reject the whole concept and argue with our guest who wrote the book called The Good Enough Job, Reclaiming Life from Work, 212-433-9692. So, Simone, throughout the book, you focus on the stories of white-collar American workers, folks many of us would deem successful if we were to see their resumes. So why focus on this demographic as opposed to maybe blue-collar workers or folks with jobs that we called essential workers at the beginning of the pandemic who may not be as fulfilled in their work, or is that a stereotype?
Yeah, so I think the culture of workism is pervasive. It touches every single economic class. But the reason why I chose to focus on white-collar workers is because, first and foremost, they are least likely to have other sources of meaning and identity in their life. If you look at trends like the decline of organized religion or neighborhood and community groups in the United States, they're particularly pronounced among the highest earners. And second, you know, the question of what do you want to do is a question that necessitates a certain level of privilege. For people that have options where they're choosing between different job paths or different careers and looking to work for self-actualization, this affliction of conflating who they are with what they do is most pronounced.
And each chapter of your book, I will tell our listeners, is focused on dispelling a myth that we learn from our workist culture. So let's go down that list a little bit. The first one is, we are what we do. That one's pretty straightforward. But why shouldn't we identify ourselves with a job when we spend so much time doing it? And in the white-collar context where people grew up thinking, I want to be an X and maybe going to college and grad school for many years to become an X.
Of course, yeah. And this is particularly true to my own life as well. I grew up looking for a vocational soulmate, for a job that would help be the perfect version of who I am. And in reality, I think there's nothing wrong with looking to work as a source of identity or a source of meaning in your life. It just becomes problematic when it is the sole source of identity and meaning for you. As so many people found out during the pandemic, if your job is your identity and you lose your job, what's left? But I think there are also some other pernicious risks with conflating who you are with what you do. For one, it creates these sky-high expectations that you have to find this job that will help you self-actualize. And if you haven't found it yet, then you can keep searching. But if we think about happiness as sort of the difference between our expectations and our reality, it creates a lot of room for disappointment. And lastly, there's a risk of neglecting other parts of who we are. So you and I both know this, even though we're journalists and our identity and our jobs are very close, we're not just journalists. We're also neighbors and citizens and friends and parents. And if we are just giving our best time and our best attention to our work, it can allow those other parts of who we are to wither.
Matthew in Jackson Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matthew. Let's see. Do we have Matthew? Matthew, can you hear me? No Matthew in Jackson Heights? All right. Let me try Daniel in Brooklyn. Daniel, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How are you?
Hi there. You're on the air.
Yeah, so I was just telling your screener, And I've just heard the tail end of your guest's comments. I just got laid off after 35 years. And as I was saying, in my early 60s, I'm not ready to retire. And all of a sudden, I'm at, you know, the sense of dislocation. And, you know, due to, as your guest said, too much of my identity was wrapped up in what I did. And, you know. So I was just curious, you know, what's your counsel for that, considering, you know, all this change in the economy and, you know, just, it's just very surreal for me still processing it, I guess, emotionally and mentally.
Totally. I'm sorry that happened to you. And so here's somebody who's been thrust into that position involuntarily, Simone, of having to reevaluate, you know, the balance between how they value their work or how they identify with their job versus how they identify with other parts of their lives. Is it different for people who are laid off and thrust into it involuntarily than it is for people who maybe read your book or have some other impetus to rethink?
Yeah, with many of the people that I profile in the book, there was some sort of destabilizing event, whether it was a layoff or a health scare that really helped put work's role in perspective. I'm so sorry to hear what happened to you. And also, I know it's a common story these days where people were going above and beyond for their jobs. They were really identifying with not just their profession, but with their employer, only for that rug to be pulled out from underneath them. And so the way I would advise you to think about it as you move forward is, in addition to this job search and trying to find what your next professional chapter will entail, also thinking about ways in which you can cultivate other sides of yourself. You know, much as an investor benefits from diversifying the sources of stocks in their portfolio, we too benefit from diversifying our identities and the sources of meaning in our life. So as you go through this next phase of exploration and job searching and thinking about what your next livelihood might be, also think about ways in which you can cultivate other aspects of your life.
Daniel, I hope that's somewhat helpful. Good luck out there. Check in with us if you want to. Now I think we have Matthew in Jackson Heights back, who has a story, I think, kind of from the opposite perspective. Matthew, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, I worked for 38 years at the Smithsonian, the Cooper Hewitt Museum. I had a three-day-a-week job. I put up their shows. I solved problems. It was a very involved job, but I did it so I could keep working on my paintings. And I always dreamed of trying to make a living from making paintings. And when health forced me to kind of stop at the museum because I didn't want to put extra burden on my fellow workers who I'd worked with all those years, I was able to now come and work all the time at my paintings. But I always wanted a job that was good enough. I didn't want the job to be too good to draw me away from my dream. You want the job to be good enough. And so that's what I did. I kept at the job at the museum. It was a wonderful place, incredible objects, beautiful things to touch and be around. And I am so fortunate to know people who love their job so much. They love the heck out of helping people see these wonderful, incredible objects, these marvelous things. And these jobs are marvelous for these people, and I loved being around them. But I'm also still trying to make pictures.
Matthew, great, great story. And really, in a way, Simone, he's the poster child for your whole book, which is called The Good Enough Job.
Yeah, very much so. And I think there's an important thing to underline in Matthew's story, which is, you know, we live in a society that loves to revere people whose identities and their jobs neatly align. You know, the podcast host or the astronaut or the painter or the social entrepreneur. But I think Matthew brings up a great point, which is that, you know, some people do what they love for work and other people do what they have to for work so they can do what they love when they're not working. And in many cases, situations like Matthew, where people are actively cultivating fulfillment and meaning outside of the office, can be a more sustainable long-term strategy for happiness.
Do you deal in the book with the inequality and equality question here? You know, like, I think we live in a time when, as people other than, let's say, white men, try to catch up, that parents are encouraged to say to their children who are black and brown and female and other things that, you know, you too can grow up to be a doctor or a lawyer or a director or an astronaut. And so does it put up an obstacle in the way of the quest for equality to be sort of defining happiness down in a professional sense in the way that you do?
I love the question. And in the book, I rely on the research of this woman at University of Michigan named Erin Check. And she writes about how the rhetoric of following your passion in a world where quote unquote passion jobs are not as evenly distributed can actually exacerbate inequality. So if we tell everyone to follow their passion, to do what they love, but those jobs aren't as accessible to everyone, it can create opportunities where following your passion works great for people who have the privilege to be able to weather the precarity of doing so. As a mentor of mine, Ann Helen Peterson, likes to say, often all that passion will get you is the excuse to be paid very little. And so I think a lot of times in industries that lend themselves to passion, things like education or healthcare, where workers are supposedly doing it for more than just a paycheck, it can actually obscure a lot of the inequality that exists within these different fields. We're seeing this right now with the WGA strike in Hollywood, where, you know, a lot of people get into a field like screenwriting because it's a passion, it's an opportunity for them to live out their interests. But the rhetoric that there's a line of people out the door that would happily take your job, or no one gets into this line of work for the money, can actually cover up a lot of the structural problems that exist within these different industries. And so in thinking about the types of passion and care jobs that have been most pronounced in the last few years, things like, you know, nursing and essential work in its various forms and during the pandemic, you know, when we call this work essential and yet we don't give them adequate compensation or protection to honor the severity of the work that people are doing, all that framing it as a passion or a vocation or a calling does is obscure a lot of the problems that exist within these different fields.
Kay in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kay.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to call in. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and my husband works full-time in a kind of high-level position in a law firm. And so we're kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum from each other in terms of a good enough job. But I feel like in some ways I have the good enough job. I sort of had to give up some of my career trajectory to be a stay-at-home mom, but I definitely like depend on him to make it possible as well. So we're kind of navigating this question in a different way in our own home. Sorry.
Proving that you are not lying about being a stay-at-home mom. Another baby makes their radio debut. What's your kid's name?
Eunice.
Eunice, thanks for making your radio debut. See, now I should say, be quiet while your mom's on the radio, but I'm not. I'm going to say, I love how you squealed. I love the vocal inflection. But Kay, oh, did I make her laugh? Did she understand that?
Yeah, he laughed.
Kay, does your husband ever fantasize about changing places? Like maybe he has the only good enough job because he has to be out there in the rat race or doing whatever he does, and that you have the ideal job?
Sometimes we have disagreements about this, but actually for the most part, I don't think we would trade positions.
I
think we both kind of appreciate, I think we both appreciate that the other is doing a lot of work.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your call. Bye, Eunice. So, Simone, how gendered is the theory of workism that you develop in the book, and what does Kay's call represent to you?
Yeah, in many ways, I love the example because it shows that a good enough job is subjective. For Kay, a good enough job is a job that allows her to spend time with Eunice and to be able to use her labor towards growing and supporting her family. Whereas maybe for her husband, a good enough job is a job that makes a certain salary so that he can pay for some of their material needs. I think from a gender angle, a lot of times when we think about jobs that are seen as passions or dream jobs, they are a holdover from a lot of these care jobs and service work that were predominantly done by women, and therefore they are still devalued in a lot of ways, and where we have a gender pay gap and we're seen as doing this type of work in service of others and not to make a living. So for example, my partner is an elementary school teacher, and during the pandemic, she was told out of one side of her mouth that she was doing God's work, and then out of the other side of her mouth to just make do with what you have and put the kids first. And I see a lot of this hypocrisy when we're talking about work that is service-oriented or care-oriented and often, you know, feminized by the nature of the demographics who are performing this work, is that when we frame a job as a passion or as a labor of love, it can often cover up a lack of compensation or fair protections or security or benefits on the other end.
We have a few more minutes with Simone Stolzoff, author of The Good Enough Job, Reclaiming Life from Work, and Sarah in White Plains. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am looking for a little bit of advice today. I definitely work in an industry that you know, typically the jobs are all consuming, and, you know, I feel very passionate about my work. I feel it's very impactful, but it certainly is all consuming. I go to sleep thinking about work. I wake up thinking about work, and I just don't know how, because I am so passionate about my work. I don't know how to walk away.
Do you get this question a lot? Before you actually give her whatever advice you have, Simone, we have a number of callers who are basically calling in, hearing your theory, which is more of a kind of sociological analysis, I think, and saying, give me some advice. I want to be more like that, but I'm not.
Of course. Well, I'm a journalist first and foremost, and so I'm always wary of being too prescriptive. But I do believe that it's hard to, say, care less about your job. And so for someone like you, Sarah, instead of thinking about ways in which you can deprioritize work, I would try and think about ways in which you can prioritize other things that you care about in your life. Instead of letting your job sort of crowd out some of your other interests, are there ways that you can carve out time where you are structurally preventing yourself from working? You know, the benefit of going on, say, a run is that it's not something that you can multitask while you're doing. And in this current age of knowledge work, where we have offices in our pockets, so many of us exist in this perpetual state of half work, where we're always keeping one eye on our emails. And so I would wonder how you might be able to find communities of others that can reinforce an identity of yours that has nothing to do with what you do for work. People who could care less about how you did on the last performance review or whether you're meeting your quarterly goals. And through cultivating those other communities and those other sides of yourself, maybe those other identities that are laying dormant within you will have the opportunity to flourish.
And you also note, and Sarah, I hope that was at least somewhat helpful, and maybe this will be too, you also note in the book that employers or managers can play a significant role in perpetuating a healthier relationship with work amongst their employees. But why would that ever be in their interest?
If it's a long-term strategy, if you're trying to think about how your company or your team can be sustainably productive, it's incumbent on you as a manager or as a boss to model the type of culture that you want to create and find ways that you're not pushing your workers to the brink, but actually creating the opportunities for them to be fully present at work and fully present when they're not at work. You know, often we think if we just push through this sickness or if we just work a few more hours this weekend, then we'll be able to rest on the other side. But in actuality, rest is not the opposite of work. It's an integral part of being able to be sustainably productive. We all know this. If you're on hour 11 of a 12-hour day, you're not firing at all cylinders. And so not only will the companies and the teams who have developed a better approach to protecting workers' life outside of the office attract the best employees and retain the best employees, but I think they'll also be able to cultivate the best workers too.
One more good enough job story. Leah in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Leah.
Hi, it's such a pleasure to be on. I called in because I made a big job transition a number of years ago from a very high-profile, fully encompassing job because I felt really inauthentically aligned in my life, much like this book outlines, and I kept thinking about the pie chart that was my life and how my job took up the whole pie chart. But the tipping point was really noticing as I was watching sort of community and electoral participation go down, I realized I wasn't being a good neighbor. I wasn't as civically engaged at home as I wanted to be and in my neighborhood and in my community and county. And I kept feeling like that was the case with a lot of my neighbors who we, you know, commute from Westchester into the city or to work and are very busy with their jobs. And I wondered if that was a contributing factor to being less engaged and you know, showing up less in community meetings and, you know, local county elections and things like that. So for me, it was a conscious shift to sort of realign and make my work a smaller part of the pie chart. But a tipping point was definitely noticing what I thought was sort of, you know, this less active participation in community. So really appreciate what the author is pointing out, and I'm curious what they found when they looked at, you know, civic participation and, you know, being a good neighbor.
Great context for it. Simone?
Yeah, Leah, thanks for the question. Esther Perel, the psychologist, has this great phrase where she says, too many of us bring the best of ourselves to work and then bring the leftovers home. And that really rings true for me. I can feel it resonating in my bones. It's that not only do our jobs often take the best hours in our day, but our best energy as well. And if we want to find fulfillment and meaning in other aspects of our lives, we need to water them with our time and our attention. It sounds like you found that through civic engagement. And as you have participated more in your local community and local politics, I'm sure it has given you a lot back in return. And so that's a point that I really want to underscore, is that on the other side of prioritizing work is prioritizing life, prioritizing other things beyond work. And they can still be sources of labor or fulfillment or interest or something greater than yourself. But we exist on this earth to be more than just producers of economic value. And the more activities and behaviors that we can participate in to remind ourselves of that, the better.
So last question in our last minute, you also have some policy ideas in the book for the government that would better our workist culture, as you call it. What are you recommending?
The bottom line is that we have to separate our basic human needs from our employment. Part of the reason why our relationship to work is so fraught here in the United States is because the consequences of losing work are so dire when, for example, the majority of Americans' health care is tied to their employment, or if you're an immigrant and your ability to stay in this country is tied to your visa and your employment status. So on the whole, I was very encouraged by some of the measures that were taken during the pandemic that re-knit our frayed social safety net, things like the child tax credit and expanded unemployment insurance. Just with a modicum of government support, we saw how thousands and thousands of Americans were able to leave jobs that weren't good enough for them and actually find jobs that were better.
And in France, they're having riots, so people don't have to retire 2 years later than they do now at 62. Pretty big national difference. And that's where we leave it with Simone Stolzoff, journalist and the author now of The Good Enough Job, Reclaiming Life from Work. Listeners, thank you for all your stories and questions. And Simone, thanks for an interesting conversation.
Thanks for having me on.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So are you one of the millions of Americans, and I mean millions, traveling by air this holiday weekend? AAA had predicted air travel to exceed pre-pandemic levels, with 3.5 million people traveling just by plane over the Memorial Day holiday. And so the article in the New York Times travel section by a flight attendant named Christy Corbell might have been something that you read while on the plane or maybe somewhere else. Did you see it? 12 rules for airline etiquette. Very timely under the circumstances. And we thought we would use Christy Corbell's article as a jumping off point to hear your airline etiquette pet peeves and rules that you would establish. What do you do on airplanes that you wish your seatmates did too, or even if they weren't sitting next to you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you were making a list of 12 rules for airline etiquette, what would you put on them? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And not on her list, not even on her list, but maybe this should be rule number one. Don't open the aircraft door before landing. Let's just stipulate that one. After maybe you saw the news story about a man in South Korea who was arrested for doing exactly that on Friday. Fortunately, they had descended enough that no one died, but enough said on that. The article was titled, "Never a Reason to Take Off Your Socks, A Flight Attendant's 12 Etiquette Rules." So there's one to start off with. There's never a reason to take off your socks. Ooh, gross, right? On an airplane. Or maybe you disagree. First on her list, once the article gets going, is one that maybe people consider the most debatable. She suggests asking politely if the person behind you minds if you recline your seat. I thought reclining your seat on an airplane was a right, and they set it to the point past which you can't recline it and impede on the other person's space. Or at least the article says, don't just slam it back without checking on the situation behind you. Is that one of yours? 212-433-WNYC. Another one, don't take someone else's bag out of the overhead bin to fit yours in. Remember to flush is another one. She had a couple of kid-related ones, one for parents, clean up after your kids, pointing out that big messes might delay the next leg of the flight, and one for other passengers, don't discipline other people's kids. Did you ever do that to someone else's kids? Did someone ever do that to your kids, and you were like, don't tell my kids what to do? 212-433-WNYC. Let's add to or reinforce former flight attendant Christy Corbell's 12 etiquette rules as published in the New York Times over this much flown in holiday weekend. 212-433-WNYC. Call or text it. We'll take your calls and text right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now with former flight attendant Christy Corbell's article in the New York Times as a jumping off point. The article called Never a Reason to Take Off Your Socks, A Flight Attendant's 12 Etiquette Rules. We will hear some of yours, starting with Sheila in Richmond, Virginia. Sheila, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What you got?
Okay, so one thing that drives me absolutely crazy is when people have small children on screens playing video games, and it's really loud, and it makes me really nuts. So I think that they should either have their children on headphones or just be much more mindful of the volume. And I really restrain myself from saying anything because you just never know how things are received, but I wish that people would be a little more aware of that.
Yeah, interesting. And a number of our callers, I see, are bringing up headphones in various ways. And what do you think of this one? in Christy Corbell's article, which wasn't only about things to not do, but things you can do, she wrote, headphones are a perfectly acceptable conversation ender. You like that one?
I do. I think that's a great idea. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and that's interesting, right? Maybe the person in the seat next to you who you don't know is talking too much and you want some space, or you just want to listen to something for the sake of listening something to something. Headphones are a perfectly acceptable conversation ender, says this article. All right, Sheila in Richmond, Virginia, thank you very much. And since one good Sheila deserves another, here's Sheila in Princeton. Sheila, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Just manspreading. I'm a small woman, pretty narrow, and people assume that I don't need the space, and particularly the armrest, just big old elbows taking my space. Don't love it.
Sheila, thank you very much. Okay, beware. Be aware of the size of the person next to you, or even just the presence of the person next to you. Kylie in Northern Virginia, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kylie.
Hi, Brian. So I double tap everything that everyone has said thus far, and as a mother of a five-year-old, we're always aware of how much noise and sprawl the little boy is making. But my two are, one is for airline etiquette. So I loved during COVID when we loaded from the back of the plane. I don't know why that ended, but that to me just, I think we need to revisit that as a part of airline etiquette. And then for passenger etiquette, I've been on a million flights where the flight attendants have asked passengers, raise your hand if you have a tight connection so everyone around you can see who you have a tight connection. And then when the plane lands, people who did not raise their hand are getting up. And I'm like, why are you doing that? These people have a tight connection. If you don't, then please let them make their connection. So I think that's a passenger etiquette item.
Yeah,
that I would love to see.
That's a really good one. And I've flown a million times, but I can't think right now of how they usually load the plane. If they don't load or board the plane, if they don't board the back part first, do you know, since you said your husband works for an airline, how do they usually do it?
Yeah, by group. So first class goes first, and then they load, you know, you get on the plane by your group. So I'm not saying you couldn't be in group two and be sitting in row 37, but I've never seen it. I mean, the times that we've gotten seats in the back of the plane, that's in group three. The first two groups have gotten on, like the first third of the plane is full. So I think it's from the front.
Privilege instead of common sense. Kylie, thank you. Thank you very much. How about, let's see. Well, we had Kylie in Virginia. So how about Kyle in Williamsburg, but that's Williamsburg, Brooklyn, not Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Kyle.
It is Brooklyn. Hi. No, I've just been on JetBlue a few times, and, you know, after service and everything is done, they just, you know, they just turn off the lights and everything, and then a few minutes later, they pop them back on, and they hand out credit card applications, and they get on the microphone, and they make this grandiose speech about extra miles and everything. I just want to sit there in comfort. I don't want to be bothered.
That's a good one. So that's not for the passengers. There's an etiquette rule for the staff and for, I guess, the management programming what happens on the plane overall. Let's see. How about this one coming in via text? I was once seated next to a young grandchild. Grandma in the row behind us leaned over and liberally sprayed grandkids seat, tray, table, armrest, etc. with a disinfectant spray without giving me any kind of a heads up. I had an asthma attack from the fumes and couldn't really catch my breath till we landed. Here's another one. I once had a person on a crowded flight from Hawaii to New York open a full box of pizza right next to me and proceed to eat the whole thing. He was sitting in the middle seat. As you can imagine, this was completely obnoxious. I said nothing. So, thank you for those texts. Another one from the article in the Times. Deal with your seating issues before you get on the plane. And another seating one that she writes, you don't have to switch seats if someone asks you. So there's another, your rights, not just your responsibilities to others. You don't have to switch seats if someone asks you. That could lead to some hard feelings, depending on the situation, but there you go. So Christina on Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking this. Well, just to let you know that even sitting in first class, you are not immune to bad behavior, which I found. And I don't always do it, but sometimes you get a deal on it, you know. So I'm sitting there.
So did that woman who was seated next to Donald Trump once upon a time, who testified at E. Jean Carroll's trial, right?
Right, exactly. So guy gets on. He was very overweight. Okay, I have no problem with that. But he proceeds to take his shirts off. Oh, my God, I thought I would die. The smell, he was probably had been running for the plane. No recourse. No, the stewardess would not change my seat, not do a thing. It was like very difficult flight the whole way. I'm sorry, but, you know, I think that's my last time doing first class.
Yeah, so who among us thinks the wealthy are immune to bad behavior?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So socks, never mind just socks. How about shirts and everything else? You know, no. Unacceptable. Anyway,
shirts and socks required. Christina, thank you very much. Paris in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi, Paris.
Hi, Brian. I just am constantly surprised how rude everyone is to flight attendants and other airline workers, as if it's somehow their fault that, you know, the airline industry is a mess and that we're all stressed while we're flying. I've flown for the last 12, 15 years for work, and I just think everyone should be nice. And I think there's even a selfish reason to be nice, which is that that's how you actually end up getting upgrades, is when flight attendants and other airline workers actually like you and you're not being a monster like everyone else on board.
Yeah, and you know, it's such a problem all over, I think, with people for some reason not treating as equal human beings all kinds of service workers, whether it's a wait person in a restaurant or, I don't know, a handyman or, you know, whatever it is, right? Where for some reason the client thinks that that they have the right to be rude, or they don't see the person as fully human who are doing things like flight attendant jobs.
Exactly. And I've seen it just get worse and worse over the last few years. I don't know if it's because of the pandemic or what, but it just feels like people have forgotten how to have etiquette to people who are working for them to get them from one place to another, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up. Paris in Brooklyn. I wish we had Brooklyn in Paris, who we could take next, but we don't. So we're going to take Diane in Florham Park. Diane, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. Thank you. This is a great topic. My experience, and I would just like to put in a general request that men and women cover their bodies. For example, flying next to a man who is wearing one of those Marlon Brando t-shirts, or even similarly a woman in very short shorts, we just don't want to be skin to skin. So that's something I've experienced, and I would hope that people might respect that.
Yeah, so this is definitely coming up. The socks. The other caller brought up the guy who took off his shirt in first class. You're talking about the short shorts. So listeners, I guess, respect everybody else's bodily autonomy becomes a theme here. I will read one more text coming in, and then I think we're out of time. Let's see. Since many people want to dunk on annoying kids, apparently, here's this text. Unless you are offering some form of help, there should be a one-look rule at someone's crying baby or child. Please don't keep looking at us. We're sweating to fix the situation because it's even more stressful for us. So there you go. And thanks to former flight attendant Christy Corbell for starting this conversation by writing that article in the New York Times, 12 Rules from a Flight Attendant for Etiquette on an Airplane. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.